Welcome to episode 4 of the Strength Training for Runners podcast, brought to you by myself, Tim Edgerton, from Foxwood Personal Training in York. Of course, we're in another week of lockdown, and not a lot is still going on in the athletics world, in the running world. Events getting cancelled left, right, and centre once again. In fact, some of the events I mentioned in last week's episode have since been cancelled. I mentioned the RAK half marathon, due to take place in February, now cancelled. That had an absolutely stacked field scheduled, and it is no longer going to be taking place. I mentioned the BMC races, which were due to go ahead in Lee Valley in London as well. The British Milers Club elite races for British athletes with elite athlete status with respect to the regulations set out by the government for the purposes of the pandemic. That meeting's been cancelled as well. That's not going ahead. In fact, even the night of 10,000 metre PBs race in June, so that's scheduled as far as ahead as June, even that meet's been cancelled now due to the pandemic. So lots of events getting cancelled all over the place. We're in a very similar situation to that first lockdown, where you just really don't know when normality is going to be resumed on the racing front. Again, going like casting further and further into the summer, even the National Athletics League on a lower kind of scale of event, if you like, obviously still kind of elite level athletics, but not something that would necessarily be drawing in huge crowds or anything like that, but that the opening weekend of the National Athletics League has been moved from mid-May to when it was originally scheduled for, back to June the 6th is now that scheduled date for the opening fixture of the National Athletics League. So events getting cancelled, events getting pushed back, postponed. There are still potentially some indoor athletics meets taking place this winter on the national front. In terms of what's taking place domestically, there's a series of micro meetings scheduled for the 20th and 21st of February, and these are designed to be selection opportunities for British athletes for the European Indoor Athletics Championships, assuming that still goes ahead. But if we are to assume that the European Indoors is going ahead, it still hasn't been cancelled as of yet, then on February 20th and 21st there are three micro meetings scheduled to take place. One in Lee Valley, which I believe is for sprints and hurdles athletes, one in Loughborough, which is more for the field event athletes, and one in, it's either going to be Sheffield or Manchester, that's not been confirmed yet, but that's going to be more for the middle distance guys, and I think there might be a 400 meter opportunity for athletes in contention of getting selected in 400 meters as well. So those events are still scheduled to take place, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if we return this time next week and have another update on the situation and find that those have been cancelled as well. Possibly the European Indoor Athletics Championships will have been cancelled by then. Who knows? Anyway, that's what's going on in terms of racing, or what's not going on in terms of racing. But let's try and talk about something a little bit more positive. Let's talk about training and how to get the most of our training. And last week we focused on gym-based strength and conditioning work. So how can we optimize strength and conditioning work within the gym environment? And of course, you might think that's a bit of a strange topic to be talking about right now, but not everyone across the world is in a lockdown. Obviously the UK is in a lockdown, the gyms are closed in the UK, but some of my listeners aren't in the UK. We've got listeners from all over the place, and some of you guys might have access to the gym. And of course, the home fitness equipment industry, the gym equipment industry, is absolutely booming as a result of this pandemic. It's really hard to get hold of gym equipment because so many people have been buying it for their own homes because of the gym closures. So a lot of people might actually have home gym setups in their own homes. And even if you don't have access to gym equipment at the moment, You might want to listen to that episode just to prepare yourself for when the gyms do eventually reopen. So even though a lot of people won't have access to gym equipment right now, I think there is a good enough reason to sort of go into the gym-based strength and conditioning side of things last week. So we covered basic strength work in the gym. We also covered power exercises in the gym, which are really important for that transfer effect. And I talk a lot about the transfer of training, whereby if you just perform slow basic strength movements and nothing else, it probably won't have a transfer effect. And by a transfer effect, I mean it's probably not going to have a knock-on effect of improving your actual running performance. You might get stronger in those movements, but it doesn't actually improve your running. The whole purpose is that we want to eventually improve our running performance. Otherwise, there's no point in us really doing it. We want it to help us become more robust from an injury prevention perspective, but we also want it to help us become faster runners. That's really important. So we need to perform power type exercises that are performed at a kind of a faster pace. The speed of movement is a priority when we're performing these power exercises, and that really helps us the transfer of training effect. We do need to do the slower, the more controlled, the basic strength work in order to create a foundation. But without the power work as well, the transfer isn't going to happen. Also worth considering from a transfer perspective, and something I've probably touched on a little bit in maybe some very early episodes of the podcast, but not talked about in great detail, is resisted sprint training. And I think resisted sprint training is a very powerful tool to implement to help with the transfer of training effect. So depending and the method you choose with regard to these resisted sprints, it's absolutely applicable as well, regardless of the pandemic situation. So, for example, hill sprints, we can all go out and do hill sprints. You don't need any specialist equipment. You don't need access to a particular facility. You can go out into your natural environment, find a hill, and sprint up it. It's possible to do, regardless of the pandemic situation. Obviously, geographical factors apply here, but most people will have access to some kind of a hill in one way or another. If you get creative with it, think about it. Even if you live in a really pancake flat area, there probably is some kind of a hill somewhere that you can use. Of course, hill training can take on many, many forms. You know, some people perform hill repetitions as a kind of an endurance training activity. But for the purpose of strength and conditioning, really your hill sprints do need to be very, very short and sharp reps so that you can have the intensity of effort, so that you can perform each and every repetition with maximum speed and intent, and you really absolutely go for it on each individual repetition. You're not holding yourself back, you're not pacing yourself. It's an absolute sprint. If you're going to be performing your hill repetitions from a strength and conditioning perspective, with the transfer of training benefits in mind, in terms of helping your gym-based strength and conditioning work or your home-based strength and conditioning work transfer across into improved running performance, then your hill sprints do need to be very short hill sprints performed with absolutely maximal effort. And as a result of this, you don't need a very long hill. You don't need to be able to find a hill that lasts for several hundred meters. Even 100 meters is probably much longer than is what required is much longer than what is required in terms of the duration of your hill sprint. Probably if you can find a hill that takes around about 10 seconds to sprint up, that is more than enough in order to get the benefits that we're looking for. A famous coach called Renato Canova, an Italian coach who is well known for training a lot of the elite Kenyan distance runners. Canova is probably primarily responsible for the popularization of hill sprints being performed in this manner. So if we're to perform what we might call Canova hill sprints, then essentially the protocol that he would use and recommend would be something like, as I've already alluded to, a 10-second duration of hill sprint. Nothing longer than that. You really don't want to be doing 15, 20, 30-second sprints or more. It has to be short so that it can be a genuine maximal sprint. So we're talking 10 seconds duration of effort, and we are talking maximal effort on each of the hill repetitions performed. And again, in order to facilitate maximal effort, the recoveries need to be long. So we're talking about 2 minutes recovery in between hill sprints at least. Now, you may be thinking 2 minutes recovery isn't a long recovery, and perhaps not when you are thinking in terms of more traditional endurance interval type training. You know, if you're doing mile repeats or 2 mile repeats, in that situation, a 2 minute recovery isn't particularly long. It's still a fairly short recovery, but when you're only working for a 10 second period, that's not an awful lot of time to accumulate lots and lots of fatigue. You're going to be a bit out of breath, a little bit out of puff at the end of a maximal 10 second hill sprint, but you're going to be able to recover from that very, very quickly as well. So a 2 minute recovery period is quite a long period of time to be resting in between efforts, but it is necessary in order to ensure that your hill sprints are performed with maximal intent. In terms of the volume of the session, how many repetitions would you perform? You'd be looking at about 8 repetitions, somewhere in that region. Maybe not even that many at first, maybe 6. Some athletes might be able to do slightly more, maybe 10 repetitions, but on average, you're probably looking at about 8 repetitions being performed, each repetition being 10 seconds in duration approximately, each repetition being performed with maximal effort and speed, each repetition having a long recovery, about 2 minutes long. And the way in which Canova recommends these sessions being performed is you perform them as a kind of an add-on session. So you might perform just a steady, easy run, and then at the end of that easy run, when you're nicely warmed up, you might have been doing 30, 40, 45 minutes of easy running, something like that. So you're plenty warm. You then go into these 10-second maximal effort hill sprints, and it really doesn't add a lot of fatigue to the day. So it is more performed as part of an easy training day or a moderate training day rather than as a hard training day, because yes, the sprints are hard in as much as you're going as fast and as hard as you can, but there's just not a massive opportunity to generate lots and lots of fatigue if you're performing them in this manner. You know, 10 seconds duration, long recoveries, you're not going to feel the effects of them the following day in terms of fatigue. They're easy to recover from, and so it's suggested that you put them on a more of an easy or moderate day training day. And in fact, what Renato Canova often does, and I would agree with the placement of this session here, he often recommends performing these hill sprints the day before a scheduled hard interval session or a hard running session. So if you've got a hard track session or a very, very hard tempo run or time trial type effort performed, say on the Tuesday, then on the Monday, the day before, you would actually, at the end of an easy run or an end of a steady run, you would perform maybe 6 or 8 of these 10-second hill sprints with a couple of minutes recovery in between each sprint. They're not going to tire yourself out for the hard training session the next day, because there's just not enough volume there really to really wipe you out. And what often you will often find is they have almost a potentiation effect. So the word potentiation is used a lot in sports science and strength and conditioning, and you hear about potentiation sets being performed in the weights room, where, for example, you might perform a very heavy set of, let's say, back squats, maybe 2 or 3 repetitions of a back squat exercise with a near maximal weight, so very intense, very hard, but very low volume. And this heavy weight performed with a low volume excites the nervous system. You recruit the high threshold motor units, muscle fibers, and after a few minutes recovery, your performance abilities are increased or potentiated as a result of that heavy back squat set. So if you were then to perform, let's say, jump squats, bodyweight jump squats, or a counter movement jump with maximal intent and maximal effort, trying to get as much height off the ground as possible, and you were to measure your power output, the research suggests that 9 times out of 10, your power output will be increased in those jump squats or those counter movement jumps as a result of having performed heavy back squats beforehand, a few minutes beforehand, compared to if you had not performed those heavy back squats beforehand. And that's what we call potentiation. You're essentially enhancing performance as a result of some very high intensity work that you've done shortly beforehand. And this potentiation effect can last more than a few minutes, so it can last more than a few hours. It can carry over to the next day. You know, obviously, we're talking small margins here, but there can be a potentiation effect from performing hill sprints one day that can carry over into your performance in a more endurance-based track session the following day. Your nervous system is fired up, you're ready to raring to go as a result of a very low volume but high intensity bout of work the previous day. So there can be a potentiation effect if you perform the session in the right kind of manner. But obviously there's strength and conditioning benefits from this type of work in its own right as well. Force production is very high when you're sprinting up a hill with maximal effort. You're producing more force, there's more tension in the musculature, so there are strength and power benefits to be had, and obviously the act of sprinting is very running specific as well, so it helps with the transfer of training. But these resistance sprints don't have to be hill sprints. Obviously hill sprints are a very convenient way of performing resisted sprint work because there's no access to a special facility required. There's no requirement to have specialist equipment. As long as you've got a good pair of running shoes and you've got a decent hill, you can go out and perform a good session of hill sprints. But there are also other options available to us. We can do tire sprints or sled sprints. We can do weighted vest sprints. We can even do parachute sprints. There's a multitude of modalities or methods available to us in order to potentially have some kind of variety with our resisted sprint work. I would perhaps express a note of caution with respect to maybe parachute sprints. So a parachute sprint is where you've got a harness attached to the torso, and then coming from that harness is essentially a parachute, a small parachute, and it catches the wind, provides wind resistance, slow you down, increase the force that you've got to work against. But I'm not sure I would recommend for any type of runner this particular methodology, because the effect of the parachute and the placement of the resistance is such that it kind of pulls the torso backwards. So you end up running with more of a backwards lean than you otherwise would. The fact that the method of increased resistance is air resistance as well increases your air time, so you end up spending a lot longer in the air in between ground contacts, and these two factors combined are of course going to have a myriad or a cascade of other changes to technique. Anytime technique is altered in one way, that further compensations happen down the chain. It's like we've been talking about with respect to, for example, training the core and strengthening the glutes with strength and conditioning work. If you have a weak core or weak glutes, that results in excessive rotation through the torso, or perhaps the knee collapsing inwards upon ground contact when you're running, then what tends to happen is there are other compensations that the body compensates elsewhere in order to kind of maintain a level of balance and composure. Any technique alteration in one area of the body is going to lead to additional technique alterations elsewhere as well. There's like a cascade of effects here. So because of that, I'm not too keen on the use of parachute sprints, I would probably express caution against using that particular method. Sled and tire sprints, though, are perhaps more useful, and I would say maybe best used with sprinters, though. So, generally speaking, I think for distance runners, you can't go wrong with just good old-fashioned hill sprints. If you're a sprinter, or you know, whether that be a 100 meter, 200 meter, or even a 400 meter sprinter, I think there's benefits from using sled sprints and tire sprints as well, because of the increased horizontal force production component associated with tire sprints and sled sprints. So the direction of increased resistance when you're using this form of resisted sprints is, it's all in that horizontal vector, if you like. It's all directed horizontally. There's not really an increase in the vertical force component. It's all horizontal. And when you're trying to accelerate maximally from a standing start up to maximum speed, when you're in that high acceleration phase, it's all about horizontal force production. And so because of this, sled sprints and tire sprints are really, really useful for sprinters. Maybe less advantageous for distance runners, though, and they're less advantageous when it comes to developing top maximal speed, because actually when you're running at top speed, or when you, in fact, when you're running at a constant speed, whether that's maximal sprinting speed or whether you're an endurance athlete running at a constant speed, it's really all about vertical force production. Horizontal force production is maximized when you're changing speed, whether that be speeding up or slowing down. Obviously, as performance runners, we're not overly concerned about slowing down, but a sprinter is concerned about the acceleration phase where you're rapidly increasing your running speed. And so for that reason, a sprinter needs to be concerned to a large extent with horizontal force production. But as distance runners, where we don't really need to concern ourselves with that acceleration component, we're more concerned about vertical force production, to be honest. And so really, the hill sprints are going to be superior, a superior methodology than tire sprints or sled sprints, because the direction of increased resistance is more relevant. And you might want to go down the route of weighted vest sprints as well, because of course the nature of a weighted vest sprint is that the direction of increased force production is very much vertical, but so it makes it good, a good choice for developing top speed. It could make a good choice for distance runners, endurance runners as well. The only thing here is that, of course, with weighted vest sprints, you're increasing your body mass and you're increasing impact forces with every single sprint stride that you're performing. And because you're increasing the impact forces, it's probably less of a safe choice. So you do need to be more careful with it. If you are going to use it, you probably need to use it in very, very low doses and not too frequently and not with too much volume. It could be a viable choice, but I would personally be inclined to stay away from that particular method. And in terms of what I would use as for distance runners and with distance runners or with middle distance runners, I would stick to hill sprints. There's less impact, so they're safer. There's no equipment needed. You don't need access to a track. You don't need equipment. You don't need a weighted vest. You don't need anything apart from your normal running gear. So it's super convenient, it's super safe, it hits the nail on the head in terms of increasing vertical force production. It's got a lot of benefits, it's easy to implement, and that's the route I would personally recommend and would personally take. But also don't forget that regular sprinting is a super viable option as well. So if you think about it, regular sprinting on the flat, probably on a track in spikes perhaps, is really the most specific force production exercise of all. So if you increase your running speed compared to a submaximal speed, force production will go up. Of course, it won't be as high. Force production will not be as high with just regular sprinting compared to with sprinting with additional resistance, but it will still be higher as compared to submaximal running at, for example, your 5K race pace or even your 1500 meter race pace or your 800 meter race pace, force production will have increased. Therefore, it is still, in a way, a strength and conditioning exercise. It is a force production exercise. We can consider 60 meter sprints on the track in spikes, not even with any additional resistance, just a flat out sprint over, say, 60 to 80 meters, something like that. We can consider that really part of the strength and conditioning program to be judicially and carefully implemented in a considered manner to the training program. So don't think your flat out sprint work has to always be hill sprints or resisted sprints of one form or another. Just regular sprint work is absolutely a useful component of the overall training program and something that I would recommend including. In terms of how I go about scheduling all of this in, well, I think I've mentioned it before, but I work from generals to specifics. So further out from the competition period, there's going to be more slower, steady state work in the program, but there's also going to be more of these absolute maximal sprints in the program. As you get closer and closer to the competition phase, there's going to be less of each. You're not going to be doing as much volume work in terms of the slow, steady state pace work, but also you're not going to be doing as much in terms of the maximal sprint work. Both of those components will decrease to allow for an increase in the more specific work, the race pace work and the paces that are close, you know, not too far from race pace work. You just kind of funnel inwards towards that more specific work as you approach the racing season, as you approach becoming in peak race condition. And that's generally how I approach things. So hope you found that useful. Pretty short and sharp episode here today. I just wanted to really hone in on one specific thing, resisted sprint training, something we've not covered in much detail before. So I thought we'd just dedicate an episode specifically to that, really. But it is quite a small topic, so as a result, a fairly short episode, but hopefully useful nonetheless. As always, you can get in touch with me on social media at Foxwood Personal Training. You'll find me on Instagram. You'll find me on Facebook, facebook.com/Foxwood Personal Training. You can even get in touch with me through my website, foxwoodpersonaltraining.co.uk. Any questions you've got on this episode or any other episodes, I'd love to hear from you. And of course, I will leave the link to my Ko-fi page as always, so that if you'd like to support the podcast, you can donate the price of a Ko-fi, and that would be gratefully received and would go some way to supporting future episodes of the podcast. Until next time, I will catch you all later, and I hope you've enjoyed this episode. See you later, guys.